Thank you very much, Brendan. And thank you very much for this invitation. This is my first visit to Beijing, and it's been wonderful so far. Well, we'll keep it like that, I hope. I'm a philosopher. My background is not in climate change. My background is not in economics. So even if things have gone wrong, it's not like I'm going to show you a number of graphs and all of that. But I work as a philosopher, and I think that there is an interesting philosophical problem going on in the literature that's coming out of international relations on climate change negotiations. And I'm thinking here about the work of David Victor, the work of Radoslav Dimitrov. And there's an interesting puzzle there, and I'm going to present that puzzle to you. And then I'm going to try to apply that to a certain extent to sort of the China-UK relationships, to the European Union, and so on. And then I want to, you know, after having placed it in a concrete context, I actually want to think about the philosophical background here. And the idea is that in the 50s, what was happening was that a number of people doing theories of justice became interested in game theory. And I think that this particular issue, this particular debate going on in international relations, can actually nicely be placed in that sort of context of theorists of justice who became interested in game theory. Yeah? So that's sort of the overall structure of what I would like to do. So let me first give you the puzzle. And I just want to start actually with two quotes. And one is not, the opening quote is not too friendly to China, actually. So here we go. We've got some pessimism about the UN framework. And let's just read it here. "Today, the UN climate talks are in serious trouble," says Dimitrov in 2010. "The West made considerable compromises," and then he kind of details that. But then he says, "China, India, and Brazil never reciprocated with any policy offers and unapologetically trumpeted their freedom of economic development regardless of environmental impacts." Right? So that's quite accusatory. But now contrast that with a quote of Nicholas Stern, which comes from a lecture that he did in Shanghai. He says, "China's commitment to a low-carbon economy has been underappreciated around the world. There is no country more important than China in leading the way to a radically different, more dynamic, and much more desirable form of growth. There's no more important power than the power of the example." Now, that's a different voice, right? Now, it's not that Dimitrov and Stern disagree, actually. The issue is deeper. Here's what Dimitrov actually says. He says, "Look, aggregate climate governance comprising regional, national, subnational initiatives is thriving." And so if we think about Nicholas Stern talking about China, this is a national initiative that is thriving. Okay? So what is it that's going wrong? I mean, where does the pessimism come from? Let me just give you a couple of examples, you know, to fill in this tension. So it seems like the UNFCCC, things are going seriously wrong, but at the same time, there's a lot of exciting initiatives at the regional, national, subnational, but also at the supranational level. And so I want to place that tension. And I think a good place to go, actually, is to turn the clock back a couple of years to the Conference of Parties in Copenhagen in 2009. And, you know, for those of you who are following this, there was this sort of exciting moment, or, well, excitement is maybe not the right word, but at a certain point, what was happening was that a draft text was being leaked to The Guardian, right? And then all hell broke loose. And this was a draft text that actually came from the Danish delegation, and it was... That was written mainly by developed nations, right? And what they said very, very roughly is what we would like to do is we would like to have a 50% reduction in global emissions by 2050 on basis 1990. All right? And they say the developed countries will do 80% of those emissions. All right? That was the draft text. That was what was supposed to be discussed as a starting point in this Copenhagen, in the Copenhagen Conference of Parties. Now, what happened immediately, well, first there were a lot of misgivings about this because the developing countries were not being consulted. And that was, you know, a bone of contention. But the second issue that was problematic here is that if you got this number, if you got this 50%, and you got this 80%, and then in addition, you have population projections, then you can start doing some interesting calculating, and then you can calculate what it's going to have to look like for the developing countries in order to meet this 50% when the 80% is being taken up by the developed countries. You can see how you do this calculation, right? So of course what they did was they calculated this and they said, look, but if we're going to do that, then by 2050, it's still going to be the case that the emissions in developed countries are going to be 2-to-1 relative to the emissions in developing countries. So you're still going to have double of the emissions per capita in the developed countries relative to the developing countries. Now, there's an interesting thing here, of course, because population projections are interesting. 1990 to 2050, you've got a doubling of developing countries in the population. Whereas 1990 to 2050, your population's pretty much fixed and stable for developed countries, right? But that's not the issue here. This was really the second bone of contention. That is that if we're going to go with those numbers, then we're still going to have emissions per capita that are double for developed countries relative to developing countries, and that's by 2050. That was considered completely unacceptable, and we were not going to talk about the Danish text anymore, about the draft text. Yeah? Okay, so you feel how these, you know, negotiations in the Conference of Parties within the UNFCCC context, you know, are highly contentious and are sort of ready to blow up because of things like that coming on the table. All right, now, outside the UNFCCC, I'm just going to give you some examples, and I sort of made it a bit, you know, Euro-UK, China-centric, okay? Just sort of a couple of examples here, illustrating how there really is action outside of the UNFCCC context. So we have the EU's roadmap for moving to a competitive low-carbon economy by 2050. I'm not talking about an 80% cut, the idea is it's going to be a 95% cut. Is it going to happen? Of course, it's going to be implemented, that's another question. There is some energy here on the table. Then when it comes to China, there's a lot of talk actually about this 12-15-year program. And that's also part of the context in which Nicholas Stern was doing his lecture in Shanghai. Now, let's just fill things in a little bit. Just a couple of things that are mentioned that are climate change relevant in the five-year program. So there's 7 pilots for emission trading that are on the table. There is the idea to reduce CO2 per GDP. Of course, we're talking per GDP, not per capita here. So that basically means that we have to have more energy efficiency in the picture. And the way we're going to do that is by having more solar, wind, and nuclear energy. There's also talk about afforestation, planting more forests. Then, of course, you know, one of the contentious issues is always whether there is going to be regional monitoring. And once again, there's a push for more monitoring, more accountability at the regional level. There's talk about train and light rail transit systems. There's talk about recycling. All right. So, you know, that sort of seems like these all seem like, you know, hopeful items in the five-year plan. And let me just sort of push on a little bit. Then there is also China being very much engaged in what David Victor will call clubs, right? These are, you know, a limited number of countries who are trying to do some sort of climate change policy outside of the UNFCCC framework. So there's the Asia-Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and Climate. These were a number of Pacific Rim countries. This one from 2006 to 2011. China was very much engaged in that. Then there's the Major Economics Forum on Energy and Climate. 2009 is when it started. China is engaged in the G8+5 negotiations, in the G20 negotiations, especially when it comes to cutting subsidies for coal. And then there is NGO action, like the joint US-China collaboration on clean energy. So, you know, these are sort of a number of clubs, in a way, that China is engaged in when it comes to climate change issues. And then furthermore, there's lots of action in the way of bilateral agreements. So China and the UK have been engaged in coal combustion technology, especially coal gasification is under discussion. Australia, France, and the US have been engaged with China in working on nuclear energy. And this actually comes from a very recent white paper in the House of Commons. And the idea is that if China will be starting with these pilots for emission trading, right, that there's a certain sort of technological know-how coming from the UK, and there's interesting things that could be done back and forth in the way of design, regulation, IT, monitoring, and so on. So these are sort of all the positive developments. This is sort of the optimism part of the story. And then what happened in 2009 in Copenhagen, that's really the pessimism part of the story, right? And so I want to think about, you know, what is really going on here? And when we think about this in terms of game theory, right? Look, it's quite straightforward, really. I mean, we have a collective action problem on the table here, and that collective action problem has the structure of an end person prisoner's dilemma. Now, what we need to do in a case like that is we have to avoid a tragedy of the commons happening. So this is sort of all the terminology that's been thrown around here, right? Now, I'm not going to explain to you what a prisoner's dilemma is. I mean, I think most of you will have heard about this. The reason I'm not going to explain to you what a prisoner's dilemma is because, interestingly, we think that, you know, prisoner's dilemmas were invented in the context of game theory and the development of game theory and so on. But they're much older than that. And actually, coming from Peking University, I was told about, you know, the start of modern epistemology is Descartes' Cogito, right? Now, it turns out that Descartes' Cogito, forget it, I mean, it's an Indian philosophy, it's a Chinese philosophy, much, much earlier than Descartes, you know, thinking about it. So I'm sort of hoping, in a way, that we can find prisoner's dilemmas, that is, this particular game theoretical issue, by looking at much earlier texts. And here is an interesting one. I find this fascinating, actually. This is a 16th century text coming from Muslim sources in India. They're called the Birbar joke books. And so here it goes. Straightforward prisoner's dilemma. Birbar sent for 100 wise men. Showing them an empty well, Birbar said, "His Majesty orders that at once every man will bring one bucket full of milk and pour it in this well." And the discussion in the background is that wise men think alike. That's the idea, right? That's what they're discussing, Birbar and the king. So the moment these 100 wise men heard the royal order, everyone reflected that where there were 99 buckets of milk, how could one bucket of water be detected? Each one brought only water and poured it in. The king said to them all, seeing all this water, "What were you thinking to disobey my order? Tell the truth or I'll treat you harshly." So they respond with folded hands, "Refuge of the world, whether you kill us or spare us, the thought came into this slave's mind that where there were 99 buckets of milk, how could one bucket of water be detected?" Right? And of course, this is straightforwardly the story of the prisoner's dilemma. That is, whatever the other parties do, whatever the other parties do, I'm better off doing the non-cooperative action, all right? But But if it's the case that everyone undertakes the non-cooperative action, then the outcome will be worse for everyone than if everyone had undertaken the cooperative action. And that's just the straightforward prisoner's dilemma story that we get in game theory, right? So, you know, in game theory, of course, the story of the prisoner's dilemma is a story whereby two prisoners who have both committed a crime together are being interviewed separately. And then what's being done is they're being told, look, you know, if it's the case that you rat on the other guy, right, then we will treat you very well, all right? And but of course, if they both don't rat on each other, then they can be convicted, or they can be, actually, the story is set up such that they can be convicted only for a minor crime. And then they both think, of course, well, I'm going to try to get out free and not be convicted for this minor crime. They rat on each other, and then, of course, they're both convicted for the major crime, right? It's exactly the same story as what you have here. That is, the whole idea is that individual rationality, people acting individually rational, that does not lead to collective rationality, yeah? And of course, climate change is exactly that sort of problem, right? We have non-cooperative action. It's just a careless usage here of the atmosphere of the atmosphere as a commons, right? And that's exactly what you get in prisoner's dilemmas type stories. You know, individual rationality does not lead to collective rationality. You say to yourself, I'm better off using the atmosphere because whatever other people do, that little bit that I'm doing doesn't really make a difference. Just like in the case of the buckets with water and milk. Right? But of course, if everybody reasons that way, if everybody pours in the water, if everybody continues polluting, yeah, then the outcome, the collective outcome, will be worse than the outcome would have been if we had all acted cooperatively. So that's really the background here. And it's in a way such a straightforward story, so you know I wouldn't be surprised if there's even older sources than the 16th century, you know, of that particular game theoretical structure. But now here's something to think about, right? Were these people really wise men? Were they really wise? Yeah. Well, I'd say, look, if there was no way of talking to each other, there's no way of connecting with each other, then I will give it to you that they were wise. But if they had the possibility to talk to each other, to communicate with each other, and to make binding agreements, then they really are not that wise. What they should have done is they should have said, look, let's investigate, you know, how much water and how much milk you really need to pour such that it's indetectable to the king's eyes whether it's just milk or whether it's a water-milk mixture, right? So it's, oh, you know, you need about 70% of milk in here, and then the king isn't going to see the difference, right? And then what you do is you simply figure out, well, for whom is it the cheapest to pour in the milk? Well, okay, you guys pour in the milk, and the other guys will just pay you off, right? That's what wise men would do in this case. But that, of course, you can only do if you can negotiate about the issue and if you can make binding agreements. Now, this actually goes back to John Nash in a seminal paper in the 50s called The Bargaining Problem. And Nash, in this paper, gives you actually a mathematical treatment of this. You know, that is, how do you resolve problems like that? How do you resolve prisoner's dilemma type problems when you can bargain with each other? And what would be a rational outcome of that bargaining process? And he gives you a mathematical axiomatic treatment, you know, in typical style that economists do this. He says, you know, it needs to satisfy such and such and such criteria. Well, if it needs to satisfy those criteria, then this is the only rational solution. All right. Now, we won't go into details of this, but let me illustrate to you what the general idea is of this Nash bargaining solution. There was a philosopher who got on to this. His name was Braithwaite. And so 5 years later, he actually writes a short essay called The Theory of Games as a Tool for the Moral Philosopher. And here's the story that he tells, roughly, changing it around a little bit. He says, look, suppose that you have two units in a building block right opposite each other. And there is a pianist, a classical pianist, and a jazz trumpeter moving in. Classical pianist in one unit, the jazz trumpeter in the other unit. Yeah? And, you know, they both are practicing, and they kind of annoy each other, playing very different music, playing very loud, and they, you know, this doesn't work very well. It's a bit of a cacophony. And so the pianist, you know, is a bit entrepreneurial, and he knocks on the door of the trumpeter, and he says, you know, this isn't going very well for me. No, so the trumpeter is not going well for me either. You know, to practice while you're practicing. Well, they say, well, says the classical pianist, you know, maybe we can split up the time. Yeah, says the trumpeter, what are you thinking about? Well, he says, you know, maybe I'll play 4 hours in the morning, you play 4 hours in the afternoon, how would that be, right? Trumpeter says, I'm not interested. Well, why not, says the pianist, you know, I mean, you told me that this is bothering you as well. Well, says the trumpeter, frankly, I don't want to give up that much practicing time. Because you know what? He says, you don't bother me that much. Right? Yeah, the jazz trumpeter is a lot louder than the classical pianist. So, says the trumpeter, listen, I'd be happy to do a split of the day. Give me 6 hours, I give you 2 hours. Ah, it's too little, says the pianist. Okay, 7, you know, 5 hours, 3 hours, and so on. So they bargain back and forth until they agree on a reasonable solution. So they bargain for mutual advantage. They bargain towards a cooperative solution that is relative to their bargaining strength. Yeah. And now Braithwaite thought that this was sort of an interesting model of thinking about morality. Now, I don't know whether that's quite right, but it definitely is an interesting model to think about. You know, how is it that rational, self-interested bargainers come up with cooperative solutions to prisoner's dilemma type problems? Okay? So, now let's take a look and let's push this story around a little bit, because this is a puzzle. There's no global cooperative solution that is being reached to the problem of climate change. The UNFCCC context isn't working all that well, but there is a lot of successful, more restrictive, regional, national, supranational initiatives. Yeah. So how is it possible that this is coming about? And what I want to do is I want to think about this problem really of the pianist and the trumpeter and extend it a bit and sort of make it plausible that something like what we're seeing in our puzzle could happen in this little micro-society. So what I'm thinking about now is that we don't have just two musicians moving into this housing unit, but a whole bunch of musicians are moving into this housing unit. And the idea is that it's a huge cacophony, right? And that inhibits their practicing. They all are bothering each other with their practicing, right? So now there is a concert that is upcoming, and their livelihood depends on it. Very important concert. Yeah. So some kind of solution needs to be reached. So they call the board together, and they say, you know, what kind of agreements can we come up with? And they're trying to coordinate practice times. But somehow, they can't reach unanimity. There's always somebody who is disagreeing. And I'm sort of envisioning that this is the model that the UNFCCC is working. And that the problems that our board is facing are very similar to the problems that our housing unit is facing. I think there are three problems here. Let's go through them. Why can't they reach a unanimous solution? Well, there were about six parties that at the end of the Copenhagen conference objected. And they said, you know, we're merely actually taking note of the text that they reached. There wasn't any agreement because there were six parties objecting to it. That was Tuvalu, Bolivia, Cuba, Venezuela, and Sudan, and Saudi Arabia. Now, why are they objecting to this? Well, because they got radically conflicting interests, really. And let's go back to our housing unit and imagine the following, right? Imagine that, you know, in one of these units there's a piccolo player, right? Very, very soft instrument, right? So, you know, the piccolo player needs to have the decibel level really down. Yeah. You know, very hard to negotiate with that person, because they're really pushing for a very low decibel level. Well, that's your Tuvalu. Yeah. Tuvalu says 2 degrees Celsius, that's way too much, then we disappear from the map. Small island state. They want 1 degree Celsius. That's like your piccolo player. And then what you have is a number of parties in there that just have historical grievances. You know, they just don't want to agree to things, not so much because of the issue of climate change, but just because they got a bit of a chip of their shoulder because of the history of what happened to them and so on. You know, maybe they were mistreated in one way or another, and they have no interest really in coming to some kind of agreement. Okay, there's historical grievances, often not much related to emissions control, climate change. Bolivia, Cuba, Venezuela, Sudan, right? I mean, their interest in many ways is to say, we stood up to this draft text that came about due to the action of developed countries. We stood up to them, right? And then there's a third group of people, and that's like the brass instrument manufacturers. I mean, think about in our housing units, right? If you've got a brass instrument manufacturer in there, they don't want to reach an agreement. They want everybody to play as loud as possible. That's the last thing that they want, is an agreement for a decibel reduction, right? Now that, of course, is your Saudi Arabia. I mean, they want to continue selling oil, right? So look, the interests of these parties is so radically different that it's very hard to come up with any kind of agreement. And that's one of the things that I think stands in the way of a successful board decision, unanimous board decision in our housing unit. And that's very similar to what's happening in the UFCCC. Second reason is trickier, and you know, this is the sort of thing that philosophers have been very much engaged with. And the idea is that, you know, if it's the case that we're going to agree on caps for emission control, how should these caps be set? You know, what would be a fair way of setting these caps? And back to our housing units, you could think about it this way. I mean, some people are going to say, look, you know, I should really have more time to practice because I'm very important in the orchestra, right? Somebody else might say, well, you know, I should have more time to practice because, you know, I don't make that much noise while other people make a lot of noise, so really I should have more hours. Or some people may say, look, you know, I'm really not that good right now, right? So, you know, I really should get time to practice. Or I've been pretty new to this game. I really should get time to practice. So, you know, lots of arguments pulling in different directions. And I think that you see the same in the climate change negotiations. And here philosophers have been actually quite engaged in trying to set out these moral arguments. I mean, one thing, of course, that comes in is sort of an egalitarian ideal. There should be equality. between the different parties in the world. They're saying, you know, equality, what does that mean? Well, that in itself already is problematic. Does it mean that we have equal emissions per capita? Does it mean that we have equal emissions per unit of GDP? And then furthermore, even if you agree on per capita, the question still becomes, do you do it relative to production or do you do it relative to consumption? You know, if there's a whole bunch of consumer goods coming into the UK from China, well, how should we count? How should we count the emissions that come into the production of those consumer goods? Should they go on the bill of the UK? Should they go on the bill of China? Okay. All kinds of things that you can argue both ways. And then furthermore, there is also the question, do we look at a particular point in the future and we say, then is when we really would like to have equal emissions, however it's measured? Or do you say, no, there should be historical accountability. We want to get to a point where, looking back at the history, both China and the UK have the same amount of emissions that they have taken responsibility for over the history. And China pushes, of course, the latter line, right? On the other hand, you have people saying very different things. Think about in the European Union, you often have this question that all of a sudden we see that a particular type of fish is dwindling. You know, we have to have restrictions on the total catch level of cod. How are we going to do that? Yeah, we have to restrict the cod level catch in the Baltic. How are we going to do that? Well, there's Sweden. Let's say there is Estonia. Now, Sweden tends to catch the heck of a lot more cod than Estonia, right? Now, if we need to reduce the catch levels, then typically what we say is not, well, they should be equal per capita. No, we say, look, there's so much right now, we should both come back with 20%, with 30%, or whatever. And that's a very different story than having equal cod level catches between per capita between those two countries. It's just, the idea is that, you know, the equality should be on the proportion with which you cut back, right? That's a very, very different ideal here. And then, of course, there is also the story that, you know, there is past research and development, of course, that one has a certain responsibility for. And of course, the developed country will push this line, like, look, you know, a lot of what we've been doing, of which pollution was a byproduct, has been beneficial at large because of the fact that there were spillover effects of our development for the whole world, and especially for the research that came into that. And the whole world is benefiting from it. And then finally, you know, there is the issue of population pressures, right? As I said before, the developing world, 1990-2050, population will double. So projections say, whereas if you compare that to the developed world, the population is pretty much fixed, right? And of course you could say, look, you know, if the beer is running out at the party and one group of people invited so many friends in, well, you know, what do we say about that? Look, I don't want to take any stand on any of these arguments, but they're pulling in different directions. That's all I'm saying here. Yeah. And they're pulling so much in different directions that it's very, very difficult to come to any kind of agreement, to any kind of unanimous agreement within the context of the UNFCCC. And you see philosophers actually pulling and pushing these arguments back and forth, right? All right, third reason why things may not be going all that well in the context of the UNFCCC. Think again about our musicians, right? Now, it's one thing to have the musicians argue amongst each other. It's another thing if the musicians have representatives that really don't know very well how all these instruments work, right? And they are negotiating with each other, and then they have to go back to their musician constituencies and say, this is what I agreed to in the way of time sharing. Can you guys work with this? Right? And the story there is that, you know, there's not enough flow, really, between what these musicians are doing and what these representatives are doing. And one way to get out of this is actually to have the musicians who have knowledge of their instruments and the particular problems of their instruments talk to each other and come to agreements between each other. Because the representatives make these deals about time sharing, and it's not completely clear that the musicians can live with that, and furthermore, there may be other solutions that are much more creative to work with. The same sort of issue you have within the context of the climate change negotiations. So, you know, you have diplomats who are talking to each other. They can make agreements, but they need ratification back home. Can they get it? That's uncertain, I'm sure. And furthermore, they're always talking about targets and timetables, right? And it's not clear that that's really the level at which creative work needs to happen, all right? So maybe what one needs is that one does the negotiations much closer to the actual parties that are involved here, yeah? That is the firms that know what to do and how to cut back, right? And so what I'm kind of envisioning is back to the story of our household with musicians, right? So nothing is happening in the board. No unanimous agreement is coming about. So what are they going to do? Well, maybe the pianist will knock on the door of the trumpeter, and I call it the mute and lid solution. And so what might they say to each other? They might say something like, look, says the pianist to the trumpeter, you know, what about these mutes that people use in their trumpets? Oh, says the trumpeter, I don't have any money for that. I'm not going to do this. You don't bother me that much. What about me buying that for you? Okay, I'll buy you that mute, right? And furthermore, here's something that I could do that may help the cause. I could close the lid on my grand, all right? And that may help the cause a little bit for you. All right, so, you know, they make actually agreements, or they come to agreements by identifying in a creative way where the overlapping interests are. And they try to attain some kind of mutual advantage, and this is done at the level of the implementation. And it's done between the relevant parties. And so that's the whole idea, too, that if we could work climate change on that kind of model, then things may go better. And that's what you see in the bilateral agreements. You try to, in a creative way, involve the actual parties. You get the parties to find creative solutions, and you just work, you know, not with the whole board, not in a global context, but just with particular parties that are able to identify creative solutions, all right? So why would you want to sign on to something like this? Well, what's happening, of course, is that here's sort of the idea in the housing unit. The style of music is changing. We're getting into soft play now. Soft play, that's what's really cool now. So you better sign on, because that's where it's at right now. Now, of course, you know, you can see what's going on here. This is just thinking about the whole business of sort of green energy. And that's really what you need to sign on to. Low emissions markets are really starting to flourish, and you better be on board, because if you're not on board, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. Right, the style is changing in the globe, on the global marketplace, and you better be on board with this. All right, so why would it be the case that China is on board with things like that, as we saw, you know, in their participation in the clubs, as we saw in their participation in bilateral agreements, and also as we saw in the five-year plan, where a whole bunch of things are happening both at a regional and at a national level? Well, there's a huge sensitivity to climate change, you know, because of the fact that they're hugely affected by climate change. It's different when you're Russia than when you're China, just because of your geographical location. Furthermore, of course, there is issues of pollution control that need to be solved internally. Then there is issues of energy security, that is, you want to be independent of foreign oil. You don't want to be dependent on gas coming from Russia. You want to figure out things for yourself so you get more energy security. And then there is the whole story, of course, of stepping on board of green energy, the low carbon economy. You want to participate in that. So that's sort of where your motivation lies in order to make these steps. So let me see. Yeah. So if you think about where is it that morality is present in this whole thing, you know, is morality completely gone here? I don't think it's gone. In the first place, we're still concerned about climate change and we have prudential concerns. What's the future going to be like? But these prudential concerns are, of course, hugely relative to future generations, right? So that's a moral issue. Yeah. So, you know, you sense if you want to engage in these kinds of negotiations because you are morally motivated. Yeah, you're morally motivated, you care about the future generations. So that's clearly true. So that's your moral motivation. But then when it comes to actual implementation, it's not clear that you need to be morally motivated. It may well be the case that at the level of implementation, what you need is proper incentive structures. There's where you need to find, in a creative way, you need to find certain solutions in which you identify mutual advantage. Now that, in a way, has little to do with morality. Yeah? That has little to do with morality. That's just, you know, creatively coming to a point where two parties say, I can agree on that, and both parties recognize that it's better for them to agree on those things. Third point, then of course there is always this objection. Yeah, but if these clubs are going to be forming, isn't that in a way being exclusive? And what do we say from a moral perspective about this? Now, I think that there is a difference here between being inclusive in the sense that everybody should have a chance to talk, right? That sort of inclusiveness of voice, right? And now, if it's the case that you have your clubs with limited number of players, as we saw in these various examples, the whole world can't talk. Now, that's fair enough. But do we need to have inclusiveness in voice? I don't think we need inclusiveness in voice. What we need is transparency. Those kinds of things are happening here. And you need to have sort of inclusiveness of entrance. That is, you know, you can't have closed clubs. People have to have the opportunity to enter. And of course, the more the low carbon economy is developing and the more that's sort of the new cool, well, the more people need to be able or will be motivated to enter in these bilateral agreements in these clubs. All right? And so you need to have inclusiveness of entry. But that's different from the sort of inclusiveness of voice that leads to nothing in the UNFCCC. That inclusiveness of voice combined with unanimity leads to a complete gridlock. All right? So morality enters in first in the sense that we need to be motivated to do something about climate change for the future generations. It doesn't enter in when we're trying to find creative solutions, because then we're just looking for mutual advantage. We're looking for things that will, you know, advance our own agenda in some kind of creative way. And that's where the bargaining theory story comes in. And then thirdly, morality comes in again when it comes to, well, who should be involved in that? Should we be inclusive here? Well, inclusiveness eventually combined with transparency is of course an important thing here. And then finally, there's a nice Samuel Beckett quote, which I sort of feel typifies philosophy. That is, ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, but fail better. All right? I think climate change negotiations may be a bit of that, you know. But as long as we're failing better, it's all right. Okay? Now, of course, there's an urgency in this matter. Maybe there's not an urgency in the case of philosophy, so maybe there is a bit of a difference here. But maybe this is the best we can do, that is, you know, fail better. And of course, the UNFCCC, in a way, you know, can continue to be very important in this matter, in the way that they can provide a kind of umbrella for these negotiations towards mutual advantage, and also for guaranteeing the inclusiveness, right? And if it seems like they're failing, as long as they're, as an umbrella, failing better and incentivizing those various initiatives and securing transparency and inclusiveness as an umbrella, they're actually doing a good job. Even though it seems like after every conference of parties, Copenhagen, Durban, Qatar is coming up, it seems like it's a huge failure, right? Maybe that's okay because they're failing better and they're fulfilling their role as an umbrella organization. So, thank you very much. Look forward to your questions. Shall we pass around the microphone?
Open.
Yeah, just open it up. Yes.
Oh, you don't need the
mic. No?
Okay. Well, my name is Lucas Ransom. I'm a student of the Beda LSE dual degree master's program in international affairs. Thank you very much for this very enlightening speech. I found it very interesting and also entertaining. I very vividly imagined the musicians sitting down at the negotiating table. But there was one thing I was wondering about, one further thing that I don't know how you would include it in the model. Because I think, other than in the House of Musicians, in the climate change world, there's a very big disconnect between cause and effect. We pollute the world today. We blow CO2 into the air today, and the effect that this causes may be delayed for 30 years, for 40 years, for more, and it may be at a completely different area in the world. So it's not as easy as going around the house and listening to who plays the loudest, knocking at the door, and saying, "See, you're polluting my atmosphere." Mm-hmm. But it's 40 years later, there might be some sort of hurricane coming to some island in I don't know where. Mm-hmm. And where do you go then? Who do you blame then? Then it's too late.
So it's true. You know, analogies are never perfect, right? And there's always these differences between the case that you're playing with and the case you want to, between the explanants and the explanandum. Yeah, that is the case that you're playing with, and then the example that you use in order to make these kind of comparisons. But I don't know whether this difference is a difference that makes for the difference, actually. Because, you know, in one sense, of course, I can keep pushing my example around, right? I can say, look, you know, there's huge uncertainty. I get the sign here.
There's huge uncertainty. So one thing one could say is, look, I mean, you know, there is huge uncertainty in the case of the musicians as well. You know, how much do they need to practice in order to pull off the concert? Maybe it's going to turn into a jam session. It'll be great, you know. Just like, you know, there was going to be no overhead projection, right? So, you know, you can bring that uncertainty into that example as well. You can bring the time frame into that example as well. And even if you don't do that, it's not clear. The example, in a way, seems rich enough in order to bring out this difference between, you know, the advantage of negotiating at the local level, or, you know, the fact that you can make headway at the local level, but you can't make headway at the global level. That's really all the example is meant to do, right? And so even though the uncertainty element and the time frame element may be different, I only use the example in order to show that you could have that sort of local optimism and global pessimism. Right? That's all I'm trying to do with it. And so I'm not sure that, you know, it's a difference that makes for the difference.
Yeah? Yeah, you want
to
come back?
The point I was trying to make is that really it's really clear, it's really difficult maybe for some players in the climate negotiations to see their benefit, or to see their benefit, because it may be delayed so far that that's another point why they don't have any.
Oh, I see, okay. Mm-hmm. Right. So actually, but that actually makes the analogy better, right? That makes it better, because in the climate change case, you're even less motivated to do the global thing. In the case of the musicians, they still, hey guys, the concert's coming up, gotta do something, gotta give in a little bit, right? And in the climate change case, you know, that kind of advantage of global action is even less clear, right? But nonetheless, you can get local action to start, right? So I think in a way, if we already see the disconnect between global and local in the housing unit, we would even expect it more in climate change, because you add that element of uncertainty to it that makes the global so much more difficult. Yeah? So, okay, good, terrific. First starts with the first point here, right? I mean, there is this literature, this huge literature on when you do bargaining theory, do you think about absolute advantage or do you think about relative advantage, right? And then there is this story, well, in particular context, it's relative advantage that the parties care about. In other contexts, it's absolute advantage that they care about. And then you have to look at the climate change context and see, you know, how it is being characterized, right? But it's interesting, I think, that of course, you know, the problem would disappear if it's the case that you both, that, you know, that China moves because it both sees relative and absolute advantage, right? And one of the things, of course, that will happen once China starts moving is that, you know, the U.S. can't drag its feet anymore, because the big argument was always, we don't do anything because China isn't doing anything, right? So, you know, maybe it's the case that given where the low-carbon economy is right now, and given the particular advantages that both countries can have individually, right, that they now see that, oh, there is absolute gains to be made, and then you want to have first player advantage. Yeah, so maybe you can secure relative advantage by having first player advantage. So, you know, if China makes these moves in a 5-year program, then they're sort of dragging the US along, right? And, you know, there's so much too that goes into what constitutes advantage, right? Because, you know, to a certain extent, part of the advantage is being perceived as being the first player, yeah? And having taken the initiative and so on. I think, you know, especially the EU has a big stake in that. You know, they really want to be perceived as a leader in this game, and that's what they put their money on that sort of, you know, diplomatic momentum of being perceived as a leader, right? And maybe that's the sort of thing that China is investing, yeah, between scare quotes, right, in right now too. That is, you know, being perceived as a leader. And it's, you know, it's not quite clear whether you only move when you see greater relative advantage, but maybe a moment has come where both parties are seeing absolute advantage, right? And a relative advantage that is not too different in order not to strike the deal. So if you both see absolute advantage and you see relative advantage that is not too different because of the way that the equation comes out, right, then maybe it's time to move. And so maybe things are possible now that weren't possible 2 or 3 years ago. And I think that first, you know, that having the advantage of being the first player is playing into the story here. That is, you know, as Nicholas Stern says, you know, setting an example and being a leader and so on, right? Also being a regional leader is going to be important in the case of China. And dragging the U.S. along, they can't drag their feet anymore now that China is making these steps, right? I mean, all of that, I think, plays into this relative advantage. But now you're saying, you know, what's going to happen if the two of them link up? And what does that say about relative advantage? Yeah. I wonder actually whether, you know, creatively thinking about our musicians, you know, would teach us something there. I mean, you could just imagine that, you know, two of them all of a sudden taking steps forward and how well they will do in the concert. What's going to happen to a third party, right? And, you know, in a way, of course, then it's not mutual advantage relative to each other anymore, because now they've made a coalition. But the question is, maybe they precisely made that coalition because they saw mutual advantage relative to a third party, right? So suppose it's the case that two parties say, look, if we go this route, we have an absolute advantage, that's good. Our relative advantage isn't that different, given the way that we perceive this world, right? Given the way that we perceive the world and the things that we care about, our relative advantage isn't that different. So that doesn't stop us from moving. And then they move, and in addition, they get the benefit that the relative advantage to a third party becomes pronounced. Now that's problematic for the third party, but the two parties are moving, right? So, you know, that'd be an interesting way to look at the issue, really, right? Is that problematic? And does that force us to say, really, you've got to work on the global level? Well, it forces us to say, in a way, that the global level is important as sort of an umbrella to see that this is not going to go completely out of whack, right? But I think it may well be the case that in some, you know, that sort of coalition formation could be a moving factor, and that the relative advantage towards a third party, who now is a little bit in trouble, right? Maybe where the momentum comes from. And then, of course, the third party will have to start looking around to see what it can do. Yeah? And that's kind of, you know, changing the whole culture in a way again, because now the third party is going to have to move on something in order to regain its advantage and get the balance back in place. Yeah? It is very important, I think, to think about, you know, both absolute and relative advantage, and to see in what sort of context absolute advantage matters more than relative advantage, and how it is that in a particular case this will play out. Yeah, that's a good point. And maybe it's a sort of thing to really work in to the musician's analogy. Yeah, thank you.
I'm Brad Blackshaw. I work at the U.S. Embassy just down the road, I've also served at our mission to the United Nations. I thought your presentation was a fascinating application of theory to reality, and it reminded me of a lot of issues that come up, whether it's the Security Council or the UN General Assembly. But one thing that I couldn't help thinking about is that the reality is often a fair bit messier, but it's also entertaining. I mean, you could have, for example, let's say in these negotiations, you have a government of, I don't know, Australia, in which the Prime Minister came into office with a pro-business, climate skeptic platform. So that his political stance is going to shape their negotiating team's position. But likewise, you can also, in thinking about sort of shaping the outcome of negotiations or building momentum towards a certain result, you can draw on external issues. Let's say there's a small country that hates the idea of signing up to this thing, but they really want something else, and you can help them get it. And completely extraneous to the issue of climate change, you can reach out to them and basically seek a quid pro quo. Or you can bypass the negotiating team and just try and persuade them in their capital. Maybe there's a personal relationship at the leadership level. So there are all these kind of external factors. I don't know how you factor that into the model, and you've obviously got it. Simplified things in the beginning. You've got to have a strategy when you approach this sort of thing. But the reality is, from my limited experience, is messier, but it also means that there are opportunities to influence the human future class.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's this whole issue of linkage, right? And even within the climate change negotiations, there's a lot of linkage stuff going on. That is, you could get some people on board by, some money for adaptation, right? Or the kind of things that is, the kind of agreements that are made in emissions trading, how does that work with mitigation issues, and so on. So various linkage things can be worked out. But then, of course, as you're saying, you don't have to stick to climate change, right? You can do your linkage in a much broader way, too, and provide certain advantages in exchange for certain benefits on the climate change stage, right? And then there is, of course, also this messy issue of, what if there's a new wind blowing in Australia all of a sudden, right? But that, in a way, gets somewhat addressed, I think, by this issue of, do we have the representatives who are bargaining for the players, or are the players bargaining with each other, right? And of course, if you're strictly thinking about diplomatic efforts, that's going to be, I think, more sensitive. That's going to be more sensitive to regime changes, right? Than when the particular players, that is, the firms involved and so on, are making the deals. Yeah. Does that strike you as realistic? Do you see what I? What I mean is, the diplomatic effort is going to be more sensitive to the politics in a way, whereas the actual players are making the deal, be it through NGO action or whatever, that's going to be a bit less sensitive. I mean, it still will be sensitive, but maybe a bit less sensitive to the particular political constellations that are in play, right? But then the other issue, of course, that's really where this creative momentum comes in again, right? That is, working on various linkage issues, and even linkages with issues that are outside of the climate change negotiations. Yeah. Good, interesting. More questions?